This is CIOI 101.5 FM. The Hawk is on the air.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Emily O'Brien, the founder and creative director of Comeback Snacks, which is a gourmet popcorn company that she started in federal prison. This interview was originally recorded on August 5th, 2020. I guess a good place to start would be for you to introduce yourself for listeners.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name's Emily O'Brien. I'm actually a University of Guelph graduate. And now I run a popcorn company called Comeback Snacks, which I founded in, you know, the most unlikely of places, and that was federal prison. So here we are.
Can you tell me a bit about your popcorn journey?
Yeah, of course. So I grew up in like a great household, great family. They were very supportive of me going to school, and I was also always a very curious kid. Always wanted to learn and do well. But I also wanted to kind of have friends like everyone else. And when I didn't really know how to socialize because I was pretty introverted, I found myself experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And then when I went to school, this became a pretty normalized thing, like binge drinking. And so again, I just saw it as normal. And these patterns kind of continued. I still got my stuff done. Like I still graduated with honors, always had jobs. But then when I left university and I moved into Toronto, I started my own company, a social media company. And with that came like lots of events, lots of partying, and then a family kind of fracture. And all these things combined just led me to increase substance use and a dependency on that. And I was no longer using alcohol and drugs to celebrate. I was using them to medicate. And throughout all this time, I met someone that I thought really wanted me to stop and to get better and that saw potential in me. But the only potential he saw in me was actually being one of his drug mules. And so 3 months later into our relationship, he asked me to go on this trip. And by the time we get down there, I find out that I'm actually going to be muling drugs back with him. And I didn't want to do it. This is not something that I set out with the intent to do. I didn't want to profit off the drug trade. I didn't need money. I just wanted to go home. And so I did it and got caught. And after I quit, like was charged, it was a very serious crime. I was sentenced to federal prison for 4 years. And it wasn't all long after that that I was like, you know what, this is not my potential. And I saw so many similarities with the mistakes that I made in my life and the mistakes that other people made, and that they're all based on emotions. And I really wanted to highlight, you know, the bad choices that I made, but also the recovery that people can make, especially when they find themselves in prison, and the potential that everyone has. So that's when I started Comeback Snacks.
Amazing. So what exactly is the business model? Like, I know that it's popcorn in the most literal sense, but it's a business. Mm-hmm. And so there must be more to it.
Yeah, of course. The whole purpose behind Comeback Snacks started when I got to prison and I saw how different my story would have been if I didn't have like the family that I had, if my parents weren't well enough off to kind of get me out of jail and, you know, pay for my bail. And then I also saw how difficult it was for people to find employment after incarceration. And I really wanted to showcase how employable people actually were, especially people that had been through adversity. But they needed to be understood. And by starting a social enterprise that started with popcorn, you know, something you think is a commodity and that you can't differentiate, I knew that I could differentiate it by the purpose and the mission and the impact that we were going to make by hiring people in the company and including, you know, an often neglected and discarded part of Canada's very capable workforce. And so that's kind of the whole point, is to not just hire within, but to encourage others to hire within and externally actually like seek out people that maybe have had a couple scrapes and bruises in their past because, contrary to what many people believe, people that have been through very adverse situations are actually very resilient and really want to work hard and contribute. They want to be known as something as opposed to just a criminal and someone with a record. And so that kind of became my purpose from that day. And it's been it every second I wake up, every second I go to the fridge to get an apple, every second I go to sleep. So it's like, it's really fulfilling to know that I'm so driven and it's not going anywhere. You know, it's not just a phase. It's like part of my life and it's going to be part of my life for a very, very long time, if not for the rest of my life. So
one thing I really love already in the philosophy of how you're sort of describing this is, I think there's so much to be said for when you start working with people or, well, okay, for example, I'm a volunteer coordinator at the radio station. So, yes, people share some small amount about their past, but what is significant is the relationship we're going to build, the work we're going to do together, the stuff they want to learn or get out of volunteering at the radio station. And there would never be a scenario where someone would come in and I'd be like, well, based on things you did in the past, radio is not possible. So it's like in my line of work, it's very easy to look ahead to the potential of people and not actually really spend much time at all thinking about where they came from in terms of limiting what I think they're capable of based on past experiences. But what you're describing is almost like, I don't know, like if that's all people can see in some cases. If your history looks a certain way, it's very difficult to look to the potential of that person going forward with your venture instead of thinking that they're limited to what you're assuming about their past.
And so many people only look at the actions. They don't look at the person. They don't look at the environment that that person was living in or like the abuse that they were subject to, like for a lot of their life, or mental illness or addiction. They only look at the action. And that's where I think like the ignorance really harms our society and the capacity of our society to actually be very, very strong and powerful and joyful and inclusive, because it's so easy to forgive people that we know.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we don't know someone, it's just so easy to just be like, no, I'm not going to do it. And, you know, like, what does that really do to our workforce? We have 13% of Canadians that have a record or have had some sort of problem with the police. And if we're going to like just discard that away from our economy, like, what do you think that actually does? Like, it stunts creativity. It stunts economic growth. It increases people's use of, you know, social programs, which then increase taxes. So people are, when we send people away, we're paying for that. And then we're paying for it again through social programs because we as a society don't want to include them. So it's like we're paying for our own ignorance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was like, no, like, but yeah, it's like, no. And, but the only way that you can actually, you know, make a dent and make an even bigger dent is through proof. So I can talk and talk and talk all I want and post pictures or whatever, but until you actually do the work and make an impact, people don't really believe you. And so that's why I was like, I'm going to make people believe me by showing it.
Yeah. Do you think that, well, I know I have so many questions, but I guess I want to know a little bit about the timeline. So you were in the federal prison for 4 years. Is that how long you, or is that the sentence, but you were able to
that
get
out?
That
was the sentence.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was after serving 2.5 years on house arrest. And so they actually just changed some of the laws, like the Crown, like defense lawyers, and they just, before it was like mandatory, you had to be on house arrest while, you know, the court decided what they were going to do with your charges and what the lawyers did. And so that, me spending that 2.5 years where I couldn't really move forward, I could grow inward, but I couldn't actually move forward with my career as much as I really wanted to because I didn't know where I was going, right? Yeah. Like there was this like barrier ahead of me, but I didn't know if it was like 10 feet away from me or if it was 100 feet away from me or whatever. It was just like this invisible barrier that I knew was there somewhere and I was going to trip and fall into it when it decided to become visible. So I was arrested in 2015, didn't get sentenced until 2018, and that's when my 4-year bid started. And okay. So I'm actually still serving my sentence in the community right now, but the parole board was like, no, like you're way better off out there than in here. And I'd had a great track record. I've done the work that I said I was going to do, and I'm consistent, and I'm, you know, I'm a positive force. And I think that's sometimes what people need, because inside prison, there isn't a lot of positive forces. There's force, but there's not positive force.
Sure.
And so, yeah.
And How long did you have to be in the facility itself?
I was in for just about a year.
Okay.
And I was transferred from, like, you know, a detention center, which is like maximum. And then I was sentenced to medium, and everyone that gets, that's like a low risk offender, because they looked at my history. They're like, okay, you're clearly not, clearly just a blonde, you know, a young girl who got involved in the drug trade and whatever. Like, we don't see you kind of being violent, because I don't have a violent history. Just, I had grew up with a great family, and like, I was never living in toxic environments like that. And so they're like, okay, like, you can go up to minimum. So I was actually kind of lived in all three. And when I left, I was on minimum security.
Well, I'm curious. I wanted to know, I guess, exactly that, because it's never super clear, I don't think, for anybody who hasn't been inside these institutions to know whether or not any kind of rehabilitation or entrepreneurial pursuits, whether that's actually sort of encouraged or given space or resources, or whether it's something some folks have managed to do in spite of their circumstances. When you say you started this, I know that, yeah, you were in a lot of different places, and probably different ones were more conducive to looking ahead than others. And I'm curious the role the institution itself had, whether that was a positive contributor to the work you were doing, or whether you kind of managed it in spite of the circumstances.
I definitely started it knowing, like, thinking that I was going to get a lot of pushback. And at first, like, I just started by writing, and so they can't really push back writing, but then I kind of got more creative, and I, like, would get market research sent into the institution, because they didn't want, you know, stuff from the internet coming into the institution. So I, you know, I would get my friends to, like, reformat these documents so I could still do it. So I kind of broke like bend some of the rules that way. But then, like, the librarian was awesome. She really wanted me to keep doing what I was doing, because no one had really done anything like that before. And the people inside with me, my fellow inmates, were like, keep doing this, because, you know, we won't have time to do this. Like, we have families and we have, like, other things. And I was like, well, I'm single, I don't have, like, kids, like, you know, I have a good family that's gonna kind of, like, help me out and get me out. And I had a great network, and so in prison I kind of built it. And it definitely started off as, like, a little bit of, like, no, that's not okay. And then definitely when I got out on parole, my parole officer was like, I don't like it. But once I proved it, that's when she, like, she didn't really have a choice, because I was showing it through proof. And, you know, it was actually making her look like a good parole officer when the community was like, wow, look at this inmate that's kind of been like, screw the stigma, I'm going to do better and help others do better.
Yeah, it's one of those, I think there's, like, a naive sort of optimism to hope that every one of these institutions would see the potential of the very positive message it would send when people do reform and rejoin society with the big, exciting new ideas. I guess I know there's lots of examples of things that seem to make a lot of sense that actually don't really take that form when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
You've already kind of, like, referenced the role of your privilege and mm-hmm. being in a different place. Is that something that you came to better understand after this experience? Or did you find, even when going into it, you were already aware that you were going to have, like, a different level of access or resource?
I knew the second that my parents had to put up a part of their house and they had to give up $50,000 in assets, that's when I knew that I had it a lot better than a lot of people who didn't have that, or who didn't have a supportive family, or who just didn't have the financial resources to get their daughter or child out of jail when they did the exact same thing as me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah. It's and then as I started to, like, you know, see how much things cost in prison as well, how much it costs to even get there. You know, some families wouldn't have a car, and so now they have to get to the prison that's 2.5 hours away, or they have to take the bus. Just to see their loved one, and then sometimes even just get denied because of, like, some technicality on its security paper or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some people's family members weren't even allowed to visit, and so I was like, yep, you know, there's definitely a lot of things that, you know, I couldn't control, but that I've been blessed to be kind of given or raised in, for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to kind of help others find a voice. And my family was also very supportive in me using my voice, whereas some people's families wouldn't. You know, they're like, you're, right. that would be like, just like culturally, it would be a disgrace for you to do this. And, you know, I think my parents didn't really have a choice, but not a lot of people have that. Because yeah. I was like, I'm going to do it. Like, I see the potential in myself. And then they're like, oh, maybe. And then I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And they're like, okay, Emily, like, we believe in you. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. Where does popcorn come in? Where did that idea come from?
So popcorn came into the equation for kind of a personal reason at first. Like, I struggled with an eating disorder for the majority of my adolescent years. And so when I got to prison and I was off the alcohol and stuff, I really didn't want this to kind of reignite itself. And so I was looking for ways to create my own kind of healthy snack, because I knew that me sitting doing nothing might trigger that. Mm-hmm. And so I needed like a healthier option, and I didn't want to go down that path again because that was a really bad place to be. And it also had a lot to do with my substance abuse. Like, I would use cocaine and then drink vodka, so I would skip dinner. You know what I mean? Like, it's all kind of related. And so part of it was because I wanted to create a healthier snack for myself. And I saw how many other women in prison had eating disorders as well. Mm. And then I also saw how popcorn was a snack that brought people together, and it made like, it encouraged creativity because we had like access to certain spices and things, and people would be like making their own recipes and stuff. You know, not every recipe was for me per se, but like, I like really liked lemon pepper and dill. And then I would make like peanut butter and like banana bread and peanut butter and jam, peanut butter and honey. And then I would get Kraft dinner cheese and put it on there. And so that's why I was like, this is like a cool way for people to be creative, to come together and to kind of laugh, to find laughter in a very traumatic situation that, you know, has a lot of uncertainty. And we don't laugh in times of uncertainty a lot. We spend too much time nitpicking what other people are doing and not really focusing on our own growth. And so that's when I was like, okay, this is like something that clearly everyone really likes in here. So maybe I can use it as a vector to the mission and the potential of everyone that's been in here that thinks that this experience is going to ruin the rest of their lives indefinitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess now what has the timeline been? I'm trying to think back to the 2015 and then 2018 mm-hmm. when you got your sentence. We're in 2020 now. So how long have you been, I know you're still serving your sentence, but you're outside in the outside world able to build this brand. So how long has it had like a logo, a bag with popcorn in it, like available to the public? When did that happen?
So the first, the logo was actually designed when I was still incarcerated.
Oh, cool.
And I would, when you're in prison, you are around prison lingo. You're getting documents with prison lingo on it. You're talking to people who are using prison lingo. It's like another country, right? With its own barriers and language and culture. And so I started to pick up on this language, and I thought maybe I could use this as a way to teach and kind of put like a little play on words. And so the logo and like the slogan and the original name all came from internal inspiration, and like the original name was Cons and Kernels, and since then I've changed the name because of like the progress and the more inclusive nature of it, and it's just like how it sounds and how more relatable it is to everyone's like experience of adversity. And so that was designed inside, and we would experiment with popcorn recipes inside, and then I managed to convince the warden to let me out for an event in the community to promote this popcorn. And so she let me out. I had like a security guard the whole day to take me to this halfway house, and the halfway house staff are also, they were kind of catalysts to making this event happen because they were like, oh, come do this event and it'll be good for your parole and whatever. And so I was able to give out free samples of popcorn to the public when I was still an inmate.
Wow.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so we had like cards prepared, like, cause I would talk to my family and my friends, and I'd be like, can you make these little mock-up info cards, and be like, okay, coming soon. So I'd give out the cards for popcorn.
That's amazing.
I
really admire how creative you were managing to be while you were still kind of, I guess, trapped in a sense, you know?
Yeah. Well, when we're trapped in one world, there's always another world that we can be in. Right. especially in our minds, and because I was always creative as a kid, I kind of rechanneled this like childlike creativity. But I made it with like a very adult and mature purpose. So I think that's kind of what you need for every brand, is like a playfulness. And also, but a very honest reality associated with that brand, because if it's not serious enough, it's not going to resonate and people won't take it seriously. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I guess for listeners, what is the name and some of these slogans, some of these embedded kind of messages that are part of the brand?
Sure. So our original slogan was, and it still is to this day, we're trademarking it, popcorn so good it's criminal. Nice. Another one is, we broke the law, so we fix good snacks, and made with conviction.
Awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And what are some of the, I guess, career highlights, or like, what has the journey been like so far between when you were let out for this event and when we're talking now?
I think my first highlights started happening when I would get letters from people, like business leaders in the community who are now like really good mentors. Like a former dragon from Dragon's Den, Dave Chilton, is a mentor of mine. Carol Lehman, who is a big shot tech CEO in Waterloo. She actually taught a class inside the prison. And so she, is now a good friend of mine, and her company buys popcorn from us. And then when I came out, I've met like the mayor of Toronto. I've met the mayor of Hamilton. I've met the mayor of Cambridge, Kitchener and Waterloo, actually. So just seeing how people actually were willing to listen was awesome. And, if I didn't go to prison, it would be like almost even harder to like do that, right? Like, so because of like the nature of the brand and like the purpose was so unique, I think. And they also saw like the residual like collateral damage that, prison has on society and the economy, and that it's a growing problem. Mm-hmm. People, they were willing to listen and support it. I think my first major tweet was John Tory tweeting out a picture of me, and I was like terrified the whole night. So I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get so many trolls. And like, I was terrified. But I'm not terrified anymore. But like, usually when you get those first big, media things, like I was on Your Morning Show and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get ripped apart. But sometimes you just got to face it a little bit. And then that still helps you build it up, because it doesn't matter who you are and what you're doing, like someone's always going to hate it. Mm-hmm. And but like luckily because it's real and because what I'm doing is meaningful and makes sense, there's way less people that don't like it. So
yeah, as you're describing the kind of how it played out, it strikes me like I've definitely had so many times where I've realized that some of the worst life experiences I've had, or some of the things that I've identified as the largest kind of struggles or obstacles, have been some of my strongest bonding points when I'm really trying to connect with other people. Like shared experience can't really happen if you don't have experiences, right? And so it is interesting to think of the sort of the positive side of the very real, authentic story that you get to partner mm-hmm. your idea with, rather than just being a person with an idea. You're a person who can really back up like the purpose and the mission. But it's also like, you'd never wish that journey upon anybody. But I don't know, some people I feel like I don't have any journey, and that's problematic too when they're given a lot of platforms and it's not really based on any kind of authentic lived experience. I don't know what mm-hmm. the balance is, like how people come to where you are without having to repeat some of the blunders or missteps,
Yeah. I mean, there's no like right way to do it, and there's often the wrong way, but it's like not being terrified of the wrong way. That's mm-hmm. really what makes you resilient. It's like knowing it might not be right and taking that chance. Obviously, like, that got me into trouble, but it's more calculated and it's more thought out, as opposed to when you're on doing a lot of alcohol and drugs, like, you're very more, like, impulsive. And there's still a lot of impulsive parts to me, like, but I use it for good, like, for creative things. I'm like, okay, we're going to do this event and it's in 2 days. Okay, let's do it, So impulsivity can, like, be a gift and a curse. And I think I said this before, but one of my posts, and it was, like, the curse always comes first. So
yeah, that's a good line. All right, well, I want to segue to the fact that we are living through a global pandemic. And for some folks, that has meant isolation and separation from communities they may have otherwise engaged with, or going out to spaces that may have been very important to them. And I'm curious whether you feel better positioned, or like you have a strength or resilience you can pull from an experience of like very real isolation and imprisonment, as opposed to folks feeling some of those feelings during this time.
I guess I kind of, when I was in there, I reframed what isolation really was. And I took like all the things that I had and that the things that were removed from my life, and I kind of thought of it as good for me.
So
like social media, being on the phone all the time, not having face-to-face conversations, like being absent from, you know, people that were around, and like ignoring them and not remembering half the things that they said. I was like, okay, now's like a time to actually be away from all that and be connected to like myself. And the more that you can teach yourself things on your own, that you're not really dependent on others, it actually helps build confidence. So I was like, okay, I don't need the internet to build a business. Like I can read a book and take a journey through that person's life. You can actually find comfort through literature and through other people's stories. And sometimes you can actually harness the best connections by like reduced connection, by reduced connectivity, because it's oversaturated. And then you don't make like, really like substantial connections. They're just like these micro meetings, right? And then you realize at the end of the day that you don't really have a lot of friends. You just have these people that you've met along the way. And so if you can kind of focus on meeting and like, you know, building those relationships that you kind of ignored, like the ones with my family, and you know, I met a whole other group of people, but I didn't have the internet to like stay connected, and it just makes you a lot more grateful for having those people in your life. And I think it makes you actually treat them a lot better and appreciate them, and the ones that do come around for you, and you know, you actually see a lot of people's true colors as well. But then you also have to on the other side of that, you have to understand that people are also struggling as well, so you can't hold like some of their decisions against them, and that's also having empathy, which is also crucial to getting through times of uncertainty. It's understanding maybe why people are acting unusual and like not getting mad, and we're all on edge right now. So I think that my experience really taught me how to just like not be on edge and to like enjoy being alone.
Just
enjoy being alone and find beauty in being alone and going to sleep without watching TV or watching the internet and in silence. And that can actually be very, very relaxing.
Yeah. So. Were these things that all were retrospective learnings, or were there things that even very immediately you started to observe and lean into while you were incarcerated?
Yeah, like I really learned that like I didn't need to be online every day. I was like, oh my God, why was I so addicted? And then I would actually read in prison about like the addictive powers of technology. And so I was like, okay, this doesn't matter if I'm not online today. But sometimes we think that we have to be because these devices make us so accessible, and then we feel guilty if we're not answering. And then, you know, we're getting these passive aggressive emails like, oh, sorry, like, sorry for the delay, or like all this stuff. And it's too much sometimes for us to actually handle and for us to have proper connection. And I really like definitely noticed this. And I also noticed how easier it was to focus on mundane or like what I didn't used to like to do without the prevalence of stimulating devices all the time. Like I actually wrote in there, and like, it's so hard to write when you have so many things happening around you, and you're at the demands of so many things. So just like cutting the cord with technology alone was a really eye-opening experience for me. 100%. And it's a discipline, you know. It's not like when people are like, oh, I'm gonna unplug. It's like, it's not a luxury. And so many people think it's like, oh, well, that's nice. You can unplug. I can't. It's like, it's not a luxury. It's like a discipline.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today, I'm speaking with Emily O'Brien, the founder and creative director of Comeback Snacks.
I think that's a really important distinction, because I've seen people like you said, unplug, and they, it's like a week, and then they go right back to it, and you really do kind of doubt if, I don't know, like it feels like if you really want to have a meaningful opportunity to reevaluate your relationship with like media, social media, or these items, like you probably need more space than that, or more time, or at least like an ongoing commitment to looking at your relationship with it, as opposed to just sort of a performative action of turning your phone off and then not really actually intending to make any real changes going forward. Yeah.
Yeah, and also taught me, like, a lot about my personal life. Like, before I went to prison, I was always, like, you know, at guys' houses, like, having sleepovers. And I was like, oh, like, you know, like, I always wanted, like, to have someone else there. And then, like, when I actually, like, did so much on my own, and I, like, left prison, like, kind of, like, single, and I was like, okay, like, I'm ready. And, like, now I'm, like, I'm a lot more picky, because it's just, I feel like when we have so much availability, we're, like, we don't care. But then when we come out and we actually realize how much we like being alone, and we find so much strength in being alone, that's when we can make better decisions going forward and not just like settle.
Yeah. Do you think that that will be an experience shared by a lot of people coming out of even this time with this pandemic? Like, that's kind of a neat outcome. If like we go back to gathering and people are like, you know what? I've had a lot more time to think about my relationship with myself, my space, my home, and whether or not I want to just like casually invite people into that. I wonder if that's something that more people will experience, that we'll see kind of like a different standard of matchmaking, or I don't know.
Yeah. Cause it like before kind of like I had no personal space, like anyone was allowed. And then I had no actual my space. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of like lost touch with myself and what I really wanted.
Yeah. So. But do you have a lot of space to actually be alone when you're in jail? Like, I know
like you have like when you first get there, you usually have a roommate, and then there's people that are like going out on into the community, and so yeah, you're in your own room literally every night. And like you can also, I also chose to like just be in the library alone. And then there was times like where I just like wanted to listen. Like I didn't really talk a lot in there. Like I think I told jokes and like I made people laugh, but I wasn't like someone that had like had to share my story in there, because I was so interested in other people's stories and just making it not all about you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there times where the pandemic, or I don't know, like what your life situation is now, how isolated you've been during the social distancing, but are there times where it is actually, it reminds you of being incarcerated in a way that is like kind of traumatic or difficult to process?
I think like at first I saw it as an inconvenience. Like when I went to prison, I was like, oh, this is like going to ruin my life. Like this is like going to ruin my career. Like this is so annoying. You know, I didn't really see it as an experience of growth or something that could actually help me. It's because we're so reliant on the way that things are. And we're so, we don't like change. Like I'm pretty okay with change. Like I've always been like that. But as a society, I think we're so into our routines. And especially if we have families, like we need to have that scheduled kind of thing. So I would think like when this whole thing happened, again, we had the internet, and there was almost a phase of hyperconnectivity. Like there still is, I think. But also there's a way to like get a hold of people that you couldn't get a hold of before. Like, you know, now instead of trying to like meet someone or talk to someone, they're like, okay, I'm just at home. They're not like running around doing a million different things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was, I don't want to say like I'm used to it, because like that sounds like conceited. Like no one's used to anything like this, but I think I'm more well equipped now because I was able to experience my incarceration sober. And that was another thing that was like I was substance free in there. And again, this is also the fault of the corporate world. It's like, you need this alcohol to get you through this. You need this. You need this. Like we're constantly being sold to feel like we actually need that, but we don't. And so in prison, like I wasn't being sold to all the time. So I didn't have that. So there was definitely like some anxiety for me in the beginning to like, yeah, I kind of did want to drink, and everyone was talking about drinking, and there's all these memes on the internet about drinking. And I'm like, well, like I can't do that. And I don't really want to, because I know where it puts me.
Yeah.
And it puts you in a bad bad place. So, but in the beginning, I think there was definitely like that. Like, I didn't even want to go on the internet for a point because it was just like all memes about getting wasted. And I was like, well, this isn't helping.
Yeah, fair enough.
This isn't helping like a girl that's trying to like, because I'm still in recovery, right?
Yeah.
It's not like just because you're sober, your days of drinking, you don't miss. And you don't miss those times of just getting blackout wasted sometimes at on a patio. Like, sure, like those times were fun, right? So it's not like, oh, I'm too good for drinking now. Like, that's not true. Like, I miss it a lot sometimes, but you have to think of like where that put you and like how easy it is to fall back into it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my, yeah, I struggled a bit for sure at the beginning. And yeah, pets help too. You're allowed to have, like, the power of pets during isolation is great.
Yeah,
for sure. So
are you allowed to have a lot of pets, like family, like in when you're incarcerated? Are there any?
No, absolutely not. Like, people would adopt, like, chipmunks off the porch and, like, sneak them in. There was, like, stray cats that were, like, around, and I think some people, like, tried to sneak them into their unit, but,
No, hard no.
Yeah. There was one dog therapy program, but it, because, like, in women's prison, the sentences are, like, a lot shorter. Like, I think in the other prisons, like, they have, like, an actual, animal therapy program that's consistent, mm-hmm. and like the each inmate kind of gets a dog and everything like that, but in this one there wasn't. They maybe brought puppies in like once a month for an hour or something like that.
It's actually that they run similar programs at like senior centers when they can't have pets inside. And mm-hmm. In terms of relationships, whether it's like friends or family or people even that you have done projects with in the past, was being released, again, recognizing you're still serving a sentence, but like, did you have to start over in most cases in order to sort of build your brand and work on this project without falling into old habits or without people expecting certain things of you that were really so intertwined with substance use that they don't even really align with you anymore? Or were there certain relationships or friendships that emerged that like surprisingly had very real, authentic, solid roots and could be continued?
Yeah, I think like most of my friends, honestly, they've been there for me since day one. And, you know, some of them can come visit or whatever, but the fact is like, they were so supportive of my new journey. And so, yeah, they're not going to invite me out for drinks because they don't want to see me go down that path because they know I'm still like a party girl at heart. I just party in different ways. Like, yeah. I party through my business and I party through impact as opposed to partying through like Coke and vodka. Right. So, but I still have that very fun element to me. So that I probably think it would be very easy if I, like, they just didn't want to put me in that.
Mm-hmm.
And relationship-wise, yeah, definitely, like, I definitely lost, like, a lot of, like, the casual hookups that I used to have. But I, again, because I've been so comfortable with being alone, I knew that, like, a one-night stand or whatever, like a quick hookup with a couple drinks, it wasn't worth it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not what I wanted. But, yeah, so there's certain things. And then some friends, they just, like, didn't like what I was doing and they're like, okay, whatever, but they still watch my Instagram story, so it's funny, but it's weird. It's like, okay, if you don't actually like me, like, why are you? So it's like, I think it's like they're just being pulled in another direction, and that's fine, but it's not gonna stop me from still doing what I'm doing. And people make their own choices basically, mm-hmm. and you can't expect everyone to do what you want them to do. That's just a selfish way to look at it. So
well, it's interesting, as you're describing those types of friends, the ones that, you know, drift away but still seem to, like, observe but don't in any way meaningfully contribute to friendship, it reminds me of your earlier description of, like, job prospects, where it feels like there's so many people out there that carry some sort of weird hang-up, like somebody with a past that looks a certain way is going to become my responsibility, or it's going to be extra work for me to be affiliated with them, rather than recognizing like how much potential energy and resilience and clever problem solving and ability to sort of think on your feet and respond to, you know, like there's so much more potential. But I think some people still have a very hard time shaking the idea that they're going to be working on a friendship or something, or doing everything for it. And I mean, it's not a kind of friendship I really understand anyway, but yeah, maybe mm-hmm. when you have a situation like yours, it really shines a light on that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are people. There's a thousand of them or billions on the planet. And one thing I've learned is that, yeah, people just move on. Like, then they move on. And there's other people that actually realize what you're doing. And that's how we are as humans. So you can't, like, hold grudges about why someone doesn't like you all of a sudden or why someone hates you. Mm-hmm. It's not really, like, it's not really worth it in energy to, like, give in to, like, trying to fix those grudges.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Like, you just gotta let some things go.
Well, in terms of, like, you mentioned some mentor type situations that you've gotten to have during your business journey, and that's really awesome. And then I also know that there's a certain amount of your business that's rooted in giving other people opportunities. Like, at some point, I think, you know, you would like to give other people the ability to either join your business or things, start things like it, who have maybe not been mm-hmm. given those opportunities. Where are you at in terms of that transition? So from not giving up being mentored, but when you become the mentor and start kind of being able to give access or give resources to people, where are you at in that journey in terms of where you maybe want to be and where you are now?
I'm really happy where I am right now. You know, I always like love teaching because I love seeing people like do things that they never thought they could do. Because I was also in those shoes. I thought, you know, when I got arrested, like my life was over and I had a lot of hatred for the person that got me involved without even thinking about my role in it, you know, and I was surrounding myself with people that told me like, screw this guy, you know, like, let's go beat him up. And like, that was like not a productive place for me. That was like actually turning me down like the criminal route and like hating someone so much that you're willing to like physically hurt them or have someone else do it. Like, that was just not good. And so when it comes to like where I want to be in terms of teaching, like that's what I like to teach about, is like how to overcome like the glamorization of haters and just being obsessed with, you know, trying to be everyone's friend, because that's also not possible. And then in terms of like the social enterprise world and building a business to people that are building businesses, like when you've been incarcerated basically, is like another thing, especially as women as well. And because there's a lot of I've read up on stories that like there's a lot of like men that have come out of prison and started businesses, but there's not a lot of women. And that's also because like a lot of there's also because a lot of women that leave prison are mothers, and that's obviously their first thing they care about, which is awesome. It's great that they care for their kids. There's also a lot of girls that, you know, want to do it too, and sometimes you just need someone else to do it and believe in you, because I needed people to believe in me. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't do it alone. No one is self-made. Like, that's like the worst term ever. I've needed my family, I've needed my friends, I've needed the community, I've needed my new networks, I've needed people like you who like want me to share my story. Mm-hmm. So it's really an inclusive effort, and that's kind of what I try to teach people, is that like, you know, you start a business, you're not your own boss. Like, I'm getting them to like kind of get rid of all these like glamorized business sayings that just don't make any sense. And I also teach you know, people how to use their experiences of adversity and turn them into like experiences of strength, because so often people are telling you you're a liability and they don't want you involved, but actually you're an asset. You just have to believe that you're an asset and prove it. So I teach them how to prove themselves.
That resonates a lot. I have definitely, in my time working in radio and interviewing people, because I often am going into spaces looking for folks who haven't had the platform before, or maybe have been left out of the community dialogue in terms of sharing stories, it's quite common to have people say, you're not going to want to hear my story. It's a bummer. It's like all of these bad. And for me, looking at it from the outside, I'm like, if you're here talking to me right now, then there's a bunch of embedded successes in there, regardless of what happened to you before. You're here and able to talk about it, which means that a lot of these things have been triumphs. But, you know, if you're raised in a way or conditioned to focus on the negative things you've done, as opposed to the successes of getting past them, which, it does feel like we have a tendency to want to keep people down sometimes. And it seems like such a horrible tendency for us to do.
Yeah, and it's also like, it's also mindful use of the internet too, because like people love to dissect what you're doing or how you're doing it without doing any action themselves. And so you just have to be mindful of like the dissectors out there that are just gonna, like, even right now, like, honestly, yes, there are tons of people that need to be like canceled, but there's also tons of people that have like also done very human things and made mistakes. I'm not saying the people that are like, you know, hurting people constantly and like the celebrities mm-hmm. that are treating people like shit, but I'm saying people that have like made their mistakes and made it once, like not mm-hmm. doing it over and over again and trying to get away from it. It's like people that have made a mistake once and want to grow from it and need help.
Yeah.
So I think we all need to think of in terms of like people as humans. And if it was us or someone we knew, or if it was our, like our mom in there or our kid, we'd be like, oh my God, I forgive you easy. You know, it's like, of course you did get a second chance from me. It's like, how dare they, you know, it wasn't your fault. Right. But
yeah.
So we just need to have that angle on other people that we know nothing about, but it's easy again. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say no. It's easy to be ignorant.
Does the current prison model allow for, like, are folks that you met inside who are still there able to stay in touch with you at all? Or is that a pretty hard cut? So in terms of people who are maybe working on the idea with you, but it'll be many more years before they're able to contribute from the outside. Is there any kind of like mentor, mentee or communication that's encouraged just so for people inside to see success on the outside as a possibility, or is it pretty cut off?
Like I post a lot of stuff online, which is like why I share everything, because I can't actually talk to people that even have like a criminal record right now.
Okay.
Unless it's been approved, my parole officer, and I definitely can't talk to people that are still incarcerated or that are on charges.
Okay.
So like if I receive a letter, I can't write back.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's just like a condition they have. It's called the non-association thing, so you can't associate with anyone. And this one, I was like, to my parole officer, I was like, listen, I can't run my business if you won't let me fulfill the mission. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like these
yeah,
people, sure. like we all need work and we all need to feel proud about the work that we're doing. And so like, you know, a little bit of tug of war in the beginning there, but in the end, I kind of got what we needed. Not what I wanted, but what we needed to do what we need to do to make an impact.
Well, when you finish your sentence, I guess will people who are still finishing their sentence, they'll still maybe not be able to, like, will your past follow you? Or when your sentence is over, will you have some more options in terms of who you can work with and who you can support?
Yeah, like when I'm done my parole, I can talk to whoever I want.
Okay.
And I'm already doing like good stuff in the community that I've been asked to actually go back into prisons and talk to people. So,
yeah.
I mean, going to the U.S. is obviously going to be not the easiest thing to do. But yeah, I think if you can actually help people when they're still inside and teach people how to use the resources that they have, which a lot of people do it already. But sometimes you just need to like learn like certain tricks of the trade that I did, and so that they will also won't get in trouble for it also. Because I don't want to get anyone in trouble that's
yeah,
incarcerated. Because when you're in trouble in there, then it's just like another nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions I've pretty much been asking everybody that I'd love to ask you. And one is around support. So in terms of, you know, the fact that we are living through a global pandemic and it's affecting people in different ways. But certainly when I ask people, in a lot of cases, people have ideas of like, if just this thing was implemented or if just this policy was shifted or just this change in the way things are run, a whole new group of people could be supported. And I'm curious if you're seeing anybody that's really struggling that you would love to see supported. And if you have ideas of like how we could be doing this better to be supporting vulnerable people during this time.
Yeah. Okay. So for me, it like recently a woman came to me and she had been transferred from prison to prison and then released on parole, and she had like honestly nowhere to go. And that's what the system does. It's like, we're going to rehabilitate you and then send you on your way, but they give you no idea on like how to access funding for housing or any of that. You basically make no money in prison. So I think there needs to be more of like a cushioning for people. I think that also there needs to be employers that are willing to hire people that are right out of prison or right on day parole and actually give them real jobs with like real work. and encourage them to like be open about their story. Cause like when you can feel comfortable about a place that you work, you're more likely to stay there because you know, you won't be shunned. So there definitely needs to be more employers that are willing to hire people and give them a chance while understanding the traumatic nature that prison has on people. Like prison in itself is a trauma. So you need to be understanding of that without thinking it's too much work. I think a lot of people think it's too much work or it's too much of a risk.
Yeah.
And, I knew that that wasn't true. And, you know, with Comeback Snacks, our entire staff has been amazing and they love sharing their story. And, you know, sometimes it takes time to be open about it, but when you have like a group of people that have done it, then you're more likely to do it. Right. It's like hopping on a bandwagon for a good reason, not for a bad reason.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like such a reasonable, like a human point to point out, expecting anybody to thrive in nothing but unknowns and no sort of people to look to for examples of like how it could work. That's really, that would be challenging for anybody, you know, almost none of us are operating completely without examples or guidance. So yeah, it does seem like to sort of push people out the door without any kind of infrastructure for helping them actually authentically navigate back into a shared community. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm a huge advocate for actual reintegration, not just claiming it.
Do you see it happen? Does it happen sometimes? Are there spaces like or institutions that are doing a really good job or outside organizations that have made it their work to reintegrate offenders?
In my opinion, not really.
Yeah.
No. Like prison like depletes you financially, mentally, you know, relationship wise, it just depletes everything you have. And if you don't have the support to like kind of back you up or to like give you a foot up, then you're just going to go further back to where you were when everything started in the first place. So yeah, there definitely needs to be more organizations that have open hiring policies and that are willing to give people a chance.
All right. Yeah. Well, my other question is one around silver linings, and this has been specific to the pandemic, but I absolutely would be fine with you answering in terms of your experiences before the pandemic too. But recognizing, you know, not making light of the severity of what we're going through now or what you went through, but also recognizing, I mean, you've mentioned earlier so many positive points or learning opportunities that came out of an unfortunate situation. And I wonder what are some silver linings that you've seen, like things that even though they came out of a bad situation are things you would love to see continued, even if we got to go back to like a clean slate or a normal way of being. What are some practices or things that you've seen emerge during this time that have been really inspiring?
The first one I think is our connection with our families. For sure. You know, people are finally all together with their kids or like their husbands or wives and working on things that maybe they didn't focus on a lot before. I think it's number one. I think also finding ways to get creative and build things. Like you see it with families, you know, their kids are learning to do new crafts and, you know, they're not just parked in front of the TV. They're actually like building things and, you know, getting out traditional crafts and toys. Also like a love for outdoor things. For me, especially, like I've spent so much more time outdoors because like, you know, the gyms are closed and just finding new ways to like be healthy and experience our country and our, you know, we can't just like, if we're mad about something, we can't just like run away to Cuba because we want a vacation. It's like, no, sometimes you have to work through these painful things or find beauty in things that are very close to you. And sometimes we ignore them because we're so used to seeing beauty everywhere else because it's shoved in our face, like on the internet or like out here is better, et cetera. And another thing is also, I think it's like, for me, at least it was like learning how to like actually cook and prep and meal prep and, you know, not eat in my car all the time, just manage my diet a little bit better. That was, and then also, just like, I think we've also managed our learning how to manage our finances a little bit better. We've all like also taken online courses and like learning more things and reading. So, and getting together with our pets and maybe even buying a pet, or adopting a pet. Mm-hmm. You know, I know for a fact that like there's like absolutely the amount of animals in the SPCA has like gone down so much because like people want to actually bring an animal into their life. And so like that helps give life to like all these animals that have been through horrible experiences. So
yeah, those are all beautiful. I often wonder what people don't do because they just don't even have the time to pause to think about or figure out whether or not they could manage it. And being given a pause, like universally to, for the most part, being like, for at least a little while, we don't know how long, things are going to look different and you're going to be in your home. And yeah, it's really beautiful that that inspired people to do things like adopt animals or contribute or give back rather than it being all selfish pursuits. It's been really beautiful things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've seen business owners come together and even like neighborhoods. So yeah, you've seen a tremendous growth in the support of small business. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also really, really cool.
I think
and
so
like
too.
When we start from ground zero, we got to start with community. That's it. It's hard to start from, you know, restart something like this with the whole world. Like you have to go back to your roots.
Yeah.
And I think as long as we stay close to our community and continue to support our communities, we'll get out of it. And, you know, we've come a long way, I think. And, you know, yeah, not without struggle and hardships and collateral damage, of course. But yeah, it's definitely been an interesting year, but I think there's a lot of great things that's come from it.
Is there anything you're looking forward to on the other side of the pandemic and or the other side of your sentence that you will be able to do that will be different than what you can do right now?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to like traveling outside the province because I really want to visit. I want to do like a Canada-wide kind of like visit the different cities with like comeback snacks and meet different people in different cities who have all kind of made a comeback, because I'm all about comebacks. I'm not so much about the mistake. I'm all about the comeback.
Yeah.
And even just I want to visit prisons in Indonesia, like because of like the social media, like I've spent more time on social, like finding other causes, like seeing what these causes are doing. And I get letters from people incarcerated all over the world. And so I really want to be able to visit them or at least like go show my support. And yeah, but
that's awesome.
Like, yeah. So like I'll always find something. Like there's very rare times in my life where I'm like, there's nothing to do because it's not true.
Fair enough. Well, for people listening who want to connect, who want more information about Comeback Snacks, can people even be purchasing popcorn during this time?
Yeah. So, we're actually an essential service because we're like a snack food.
That's amazing. So,
and again, like it's now like more than ever, like the story behind the brand resonates because like that's when it was started and why it was started. It was started in a time of uncertainty, adversity, stress, you know, and we're finding ways to be creative and come together and find laughter in a time of uncertainty. That's why Comeback Snacks was built. And so now more than ever, we can spread that message to everyone. So you can head to our website, comebacksnacks.com, and you can order through there. You follow us on Instagram. We share a lot of cool stuff on there, a lot of like awareness stuff, a lot of positive stuff, but real stuff, a lot of short storytelling. Like we love hearing people's like triumph stories. We're also building our Comeback Snack ambassador list. And so we want to encourage people to share their stories of how they made a comeback and how it was hard and tough, but how they did it, because that's what we need to hear right now. And yeah. So if you want to be a Comeback Snacks ambassador, just hit us up on Instagram. We also have Twitter, but like I'm more of a retweeter on there. I'm not really a tweeter. So, yeah. And then my email is emily@comebacksnacks.com.
Amazing. I find these conversations full of so much optimism and so many, like, I don't know, I guess it's like maybe you and I just have that in common, but it's so nice to hear of places where people can find good news and stories of success and thriving that are still relatable, that still have that struggle piece behind them.
Yeah, because you don't want to hear just like la-di-da, good positivity, because like that's also not real.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's also a lot of like suffering that happened to everyone, and so you have to address the suffering, but you also have to address how to overcome it and truth it and what you need to overcome it, because no one can do it alone. So.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today and sharing your journey, and good luck with Comeback Snacks.
Thank you so much.
So once again, that was Emily O'Brien, founder and creative director of Comeback Snacks. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in